Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. More than 500,000 Americans are arrested each year for smoking pot. These are ordinary citizens like you and me whose lives and careers are being needlessly destroyed. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Today, it is Wednesday, August 29th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to help end marijuana prohibition in America. We can do it together. Just visit norml.org to make your donation or get involved today. We've got another excellent audio stash for you here today, folks. We're going to speak with Matt Simon from SendTheRightMessage.com and hear from more of our presidential candidates and presidential hopefuls on the issue of medical marijuana and the so-called drug war in America. You can learn more about Matt Simon and his project at SendTheRightMessage.com. That's coming up for you today. We also have Dr. Mitch Earlywine in our Wednesday Cannabis Science segment here today. Mitch is going to talk about the differences between the pot of today and the pot of yesteryear. Is there a big difference, or is there also a difference in how a 50-year-old perceives a marijuana high as opposed to a 21-year-old? All that here today on Normal's Daily Audio Stash in our Cannabis Science segment. Let's get right into it today with our interview with Matt Simon at SendTheRightMessage.com.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming?
We're continuing the start of our coverage of Smoke the Vote 2008 and the U.S. presidential race. Yesterday, we spoke with Granite Staters for Medical Marijuana's Stuart Cooper and played clips from John Edwards and Barack Obama answering questions on medical marijuana. Granite Staters is an MPP project in New Hampshire, and today we're going to speak with an independent blogger and videographer, Matt Simon, about his website, SendTheRightMessage.com. Matt's appeared here on the Audio Stash on a number of occasions as he worked towards a medical marijuana legislation effort in New Hampshire this year as well. But Matt and his volunteers at SendTheRightMessage.com have been attending candidate events and confronting presidential candidates about marijuana and the so-called war on drugs in general. Matt has elicited some telling responses, and our listeners can see all of the videos and read Matt's very good blogs that go with them up at SendTheRightMessage.com. Today we're going to play some audio of Mitt Romney, Ron Paul, and Bill Richardson that Matt has recorded. Matt, welcome back here to the Audio Stash today.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be back on.
Great to have you back here, Matt. You've been doing a great job up there and have some very interesting interactions lately with presidential candidates. Matt, tell us about SendTheRightMessage.com and what you're doing in the Live Free or Die state.
Well, we think that they should have to answer tough questions about the war on drugs and the war on marijuana, and I didn't see anybody else asking them, and it's the off-season from the legislature, so it's definitely seemed like the thing to do, and I've just been in my spare time and trying to round up everybody I can to to go with me to town hall meetings, because we do have just incredible access to the candidates here in New Hampshire. So if we can get them on video answering questions and write articles about them and post those videos to YouTube and take advantage of the technology that's available to us, we think we can really affect the debate in this election.
Now, Matt, tell us about the context for some of these videos and encounters. Many of them seem like they're at very small events, even people's houses. The one video with Ron Paul, he's not even in a suit. He's just in a casual shirt and pants.
Right. That's typical for what that was a county GOP picnic where they have a straw poll. Senator Sununu was there and gave a speech. Former Congressman Jeb Bradley gave a little speech. But really, it was just Mike Huckabee was also there, the governor of Arkansas, who came in second in the Iowa straw poll, and his campaign's doing pretty well. But they tend to dress casually at those events, and it is possible to walk up and talk to them. And a lot of our other encounters have been more at town hall meeting type events. My encounter with John McCain was in a room full of 250 people, and that's a very different experience to stand up in a room full of 250, in this case, senior citizens, all of whom I'm sure are outright prohibitionists, and ask a war on drug question. It's very different than talking to Ron Paul on a beautiful day on a Saturday afternoon.
Righto. And, you know, when you stand up to ask questions like this at town hall meetings, what kinds of reactions do you get? And, you know, let me also ask, are the candidates at all camera shy for these video recordings?
Well, at the town hall meeting, there are several cameras on them, and they know the cameras are on them. And for the big town hall meetings with a candidate like McCain or with Mitt Romney, and when I get around to chasing the Democrats a little bit more, the Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama type crowds are pretty huge, and it's tough to get a question asked. So you have to either try to get an aisle seat and, you know, dress respectably. I try to dress like, you know, Joe Republican and play it straight. I'll even put on a sticker for the campaign if that's what it takes to be able to get my question asked in front of the crowd. And frankly, that is tough work. I don't really enjoy doing it, but I feel like they're going to get the same old questions every single time, and it'll be about the war and immigration and health care. Not that those aren't important issues, but we have a tremendously disastrous policy failure known as the war on drugs and the war on marijuana that needs to be reassessed, and this is the only way I know to get that issue raised in the public sphere that's accessible to us here in New Hampshire. So that's what we're trying to do.
Righto. Let's talk about some of these specific encounters you've had there with candidates. We'll start with Bill Richardson. Here's the audio of that encounter with New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson on the campaign trail. This video up at sendtherightmessage.com.
About your support for medical marijuana in New Mexico. I want to thank you for that and ask you why you thought that was an important reform for your state.
Okay. You got the easy ones for me.
78% of American people are ready for this.
Well, I remember, I sometimes react, maybe not as a policy wonk. I react to things when they come to me. And I remember in New Mexico, there were maybe 10 people that came to me, and it was sort of a town meeting. I have a lot of these. I just grew up. And they said, you know, Governor, we have all something in common. They said, what's that? We have cancer, and many of us are terminal, and we just want something to ease the pain. And I remember knowing and learning about how we're not focusing in this country on cancer research, treatment, or preventive measures, or finding a cure, National Cancer Institute, funding goes down, it's flat. And they say, we want medical marijuana to ease our pain. And I said, well, I'm not for decriminalizing marijuana, and I'm not going to do that. But can we find a way that this is properly handled and measured? My health department administers it. They said yes. And so we did it, and we became the 10th state to do it. I got all the sheriffs in the United States mad at me, but I believe the war on drugs is not working. Now, I'm tough on crime. You know, I'm not going to let somebody out that commits a violent crime. And I know we've got problems in our prisons, but I have more treatment of our incarcerated people, more rehabilitation, more education.
And Matt, that seemed like a very intimate gathering where Richardson is speaking there.
That was a smaller event. I talked to him back in June, and his campaign, I think, has grown a lot since then. There were probably 40 or 50 people in a small room at a small town library in the town of Candia, New Hampshire. And I just I knew his history with medical marijuana, being the first governor of a state to stand up and actively support medical marijuana legislation and, you know, call legislators before the vote and lobby them and really push for it and sign the bill. If we'd had that kind of support from Governor John Lynch here in New Hampshire, we would have, I think, easily passed our medical marijuana bill this year. It failed by only a few votes in our House of Representatives. So I wanted to thank Bill Richardson for that and ask him why he thought that was an important reform for his state. And he gave me a great answer. I really didn't expect that good of an answer. He went on to, he explained how 10 cancer patients had approached him and asked for access to medical marijuana. And in the process of answering me, he went on to say, "I believe the war on drugs is not working." And I don't know what he means specifically in terms of what policy reforms he would support or wouldn't support, but I saw a willingness in him to reassess a failed drug policy across the board, and that was something that I thought was very encouraging and something that I wanted to promote as much as possible on the Internet.
Now let's move on to some of the Republican candidates you encountered there, Matt. Let's begin with Mitt Romney. Here's some audio from that encounter at a town hall meeting there.
Governor, thank you for encouraging people to ask you anything. I think that's important to the process. The next U.S. president will preside over the 40th anniversary of the war on drugs. Do you think we're winning the war on drugs? And if not, what would you do differently as president?
You know, it's been disappointing to see the trajectory of the war on drugs. Are we making progress in some areas? Yes, we spend about $750 million in Colombia alone to help them eradicate the growth of cocaine there. We're spending a substantial amount in Afghanistan to try and replace that crop. We're spending a lot trying to keep drugs from growing around the world. We're not doing a terrific job in helping kids decide not to try drugs. And that's one of the frustrations I have. People talk about medicinal marijuana. And, you know, you hear that story, people who are sick need medicinal marijuana. But marijuana is the entry drug for people trying to get kids hooked on drugs. I don't want medicinal marijuana. There are synthetic forms of marijuana that are available for people who need it for prescription. Don't open the doorway to medicinal marijuana. I think we're going to have to engage in a much more effective marketing effort to our kids. It's really funny. I looked at statistics over the weekend on the incidence of drug use by young people. And prior to the Reagan administration, it was way up here. And then Nancy Reagan started campaigning on the idea of say no to drugs. Just say no. We all remember that campaign. And drug use dropped pretty significantly. And then when Bill Clinton, and all during the Reagan years and the Bush years, drug use just kept it coming down, down, down. And then Bill Clinton said he didn't inhale, and it was kind of funny, and drug use started going up again. And then when President Bush, George Walker Bush, got elected, it started coming down again. And so there's no question but that the example and the bully pulpit that comes from the White House has an impact on drug use in our country. And I believe we have to take a much more effective, much more directly engaged effort to our kids across the country to market to them the perils and the evils of getting involved in drugs, the evils for their own life. And, you know, we're great marketers. Americans can convince you to buy a bottle of soda water from France for, I don't know, $2 a bottle or $3. I mean, how in the world our marketing people come up with these things? I do not know. And I succumb like everybody else. We need to have these same marketing folks come work with us to reinstitute a campaign as powerful as Just Say No was.
Again, that's Republican Mitt Romney there. And Matt, what did you think of Romney's answer overall?
I don't know where to start with that guy. He said an awful lot in his answer. He started off, I asked him if we were winning the war on drugs. I pointed out that we'd had a war on drugs for a declared war on drugs. You know, drug prohibition has been around longer than that, but you know, Richard Nixon's war on drugs was declared in 1970, and my question was, the next president will preside over the 40th anniversary of the war on drugs. Are we winning the war on drugs? And if not, what would you do differently as president? So it's not a hostile question, but it's a question that would give him a chance to do what he does typically when he doesn't know what he's talking about, and that's free associate and say things that pop into his head. And he started off by saying, well, it's been disappointing, the trajectory of the war on drugs, but we're making a lot of progress. We're spending $750 million in Colombia to help them eradicate their cocaine crop and all this. And I don't understand how spending $750 million is a sign of progress when you've done nothing to reduce the availability of a drug in the United States. So that it started off pretty ridiculous and went downhill from there. He said, but what we need to do really is reduce the demand for drugs. Okay, well, yeah, we'd all, I think, like to see the demand for hard drugs, the drugs that people are really hurting themselves with. We'd like to see that decrease. But how are we going to do that? And his answer is, well, we need another campaign like Just Say No, because that worked so well for us in the 1980s.
And again, folks, you can view the whole Romney video at sendtherightmessage.com. Now, a blogger at reason.com did use this Romney video as a basis for one of their posts. So having the content out there does seem to be having a wider impact, Matt.
I think so, too. And we've, you know, just posted the McCain video last week, and it got a remarkable response. Actually, my article got over 7,000 views so far, and the Ron Paul article that we just put up yesterday, or actually last night at 2:30 in the morning, I think that one will do pretty well as well, given how much support Ron Paul has with, you know, the tech-savvy internet people across the country. I expect a lot of people will read that and pass that along. And, of course, it hits on all the other candidates as well. And it's a study in contrast, I think, between Ron Paul and John McCain and Ron Paul and Mitt Romney. All of them are Republicans, but they're saying radically opposite things about drug prohibition. I think one of them's telling the truth, and two of them are making things up and lying and doing whatever they think it takes to win a Republican nomination. But I think they're underestimating voters. I think that even a lot of Republican voters are waking up and smelling the coffee and understanding that these policies just aren't achieving the results that they intend. You know, conservatives take what they think is a law and order approach to drug and marijuana policy, and we hear that law and order all the time, but it really causes lawlessness and disorder. And if we can help people understand that and use the knowledge that we have, you know, economists like Milton Friedman and even William F. Buckley, who's regarded as the father of modern conservatism, you know, was an opponent of prohibition for decades and said the same things over and over again. The war on drugs and the war on marijuana caused more problems than the drugs themselves.
And again, folks can view this McCain video at sendtherightmessage.com. And Matt, you know, what kind of response have you gotten about the project so far?
Well, all the feedback that I've heard has been very positive. I've shared it pretty aggressively with as many Republicans as I possibly can. I also blog on a site called NHinsider.com, which deals with state politics in New Hampshire, and I posted it there, and one of my fellow bloggers is a McCain supporter, and I tried to get him in conversation. And people, you know, the reaction tends to be, well, yeah, you have some valid points there. I'm sure that we should maybe think about that a little more. I don't know. You know, but really, I think with the Republican Party, and in terms of moving policy forward, this isn't just about electing an anti-prohibitionist president, because I'll be honest with you, that's a long shot, you know, in this particular election. One of these days we'll have one, I believe. But in terms of advancing state policy reforms, we need to make it possible for Republican state legislators to be able to stand up and speak in favor of marijuana policy reform and vote for it without fear of reprisal, without fear of their party bosses coming down on it. We need to make it at least safe to be an anti-prohibitionist Republican within the Republican Party, and then we'll be able to pass a lot more of our legislation. The same is true with the Democratic Party. There's certainly a lot of the establishment leadership opposes reform, and a lot of the grassroots progressive types are for reform. So it's a matter of, I think, sending the right message and pushing the envelope every way you can and educating people about the real effects of policy.
You also noted on your blog that later that same night that you got a question to John McCain, another person at that same event specifically asked him what he would do to stop the federal raids on medical marijuana facilities in California. McCain's answer was, quote, nothing, close quote. Pretty harsh words there from the Arizona senator, and really towing the Bush administration party line on this 100%.
That's right, and it's totally, I mean, Republicans always, or many Republicans, speak very highly of the 10th Amendment, of the concept of state rights, and I'm not sure they understand fully what it means. I mean, it's pretty simple. People, you know, may remember out there from civics class, the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution are the Bill of Rights. The 10th Amendment is an amendment that the U.S. Constitution would not have been ratified without the 10th Amendment. It was designed to keep power decentralized among the states. It simply says that any power that's not delegated specifically to the federal government is left to the states. And obviously, there's nothing in the Constitution that gives the federal government authority over drug policy and any kind of prohibition of personal choice about what substances to ingest. That's very much an early 20th century invention, and it's really disappointing to see that when you have states and voters in states turning out and voting and saying, we want this policy, and the federal government says, no, you can't have it, and it's Republicans, people who talk about the 10th Amendment and people who claim to believe in states' rights, who are the ones cracking down on a state that makes a choice that they happen to not like. So they like the 10th Amendment, they like the concept of federalism when it suits them, and apparently not when they don't.
And now for something completely different from McCain and Romney, Ron Paul. Here's audio from your interaction with him. And again, folks can view the full video at sendtherightmessage.com.
Speaking of the size of the federal government, how important do you think the 10th Amendment is, and how would you implement it? How would your implementation of it be different from the current administration?
Well, I would never enforce the laws that are unconstitutional. It's the state's responsibility on certain medical procedures and medical choices. I would allow the states to determine that. The state law should prevail, not the federal government.
Right. Are the DEA raids on medical marijuana clinics important to continue, or should we stop those?
No, we should stop those because they're unconstitutional in the state. You're not being compassionate by taking medical marijuana from somebody who's suffering from cancer or AIDS. And people should have freedom of choice. And we certainly should respect the law, and the law says the states should be able to determine this.
Speaking of the war on drugs, do you see the comparison between alcohol prohibition and the war on our current war on drugs?
It's exactly the same. Prohibition doesn't work. Prohibition causes crime. And we treat alcoholism now as a medical problem, and I, as a physician, think we should treat a drug addiction as a medical problem, not as a crime. But when people commit violence, whether they're under the influence of drugs, prescription drugs, illegal drugs, or alcohol, they should be punished severely. And people should know about it. But we shouldn't be putting people in prison for life with no chance of getting out of prison that never had committed a violent crime. At the same time, we hear cases where murderers and rapists get out after 5 or 10 years or never even go to prison. It doesn't make any sense. So the whole war on drugs is just about as disastrous as the war in Iraq.
Congressman Ron Paul there in New Hampshire. He's appeared here on the Audio Stash podcast 4 times this year, and it just seems he was just as frank and direct with a couple of guys with a video camera as he is with really the whole media and with us here at the podcast. He's also got a very consistent message on these questions of the so-called drug war and on medical marijuana.
Sure. And he won 73% of the vote at that straw poll. So the Republican candidates here in New Hampshire are having trouble getting, you know, they have their supporters and their people that are going to vote for them, but the Republican Party base in this state is shrinking dramatically. You know, they lost both houses of the state, both the House and the Senate had been controlled by the Republican Party for almost 100 years, and they lost that this time around, and now they're trying to figure out how they're going to get it back, and they're finding that their base has shrunk. So when they see all of these enthusiastic supporters of a more libertarian Republican, somebody who is wanting to go back to the Constitution and back to the old principles of the Republican Party of personal liberty and you know, notions like a man's home is his castle, which is as strong a basis for freedom as anything. People ought to be able to do what they want in their own homes as long as they're not hurting anybody else. And if we had that, we would certainly have a strong defense against prohibitionism and a greater degree of personal liberty.
And Matt, what's next for you there at sendtherightmessage.com? When might you next be interacting with some candidates?
Well, it's difficult, Chris. We watch the calendars. It's hard to know exactly what's going to happen next. I'm working two jobs, and most of the people that are doing this we're all volunteers. A lot of people think I'm on some salary, and they ask me how much money I'm making, and the organization's never even bought me a tank of gas. This is a labor of love. If people want to support what we're doing, we hope they'll come to the website and make a contribution. But it's on a, this candidate's coming in a couple days. Can we get there? Can I get somebody to have the camera? And it's a scramble to try to make it happen and put it together. But I'm really happy with the last few weeks of activity that we've had, and I hope to be able to build on it now that we've been able to show some support for this and create some buzz.
Right on, man. Matt, this has been a great conversation here today. I want to thank you so much for letting us play some of that audio. You're doing an awesome job up there, and I look forward to checking in with you again as the presidential campaign season moves into full swing here very soon.
Much appreciated, Chris.
Thanks again, Matt. Matt Simon is the coordinator of sendtherightmessage.com. We have links to them on our website at normalaudiostash.com. They've got videos of many of the presidential candidates up there answering questions on the so-called war on drugs and on marijuana specifically. Again, that site is sendtherightmessage.com. Stay tuned. We've got our cannabis science segment with Mitch Earlywine coming up right after this.
76% of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana, and over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and coworkers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. My name is Keith Stropp, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
Wednesday here on the Audio Stash, we get the chance to check in with Dr. Mitch Earlywine in our Cannabis Science segment. Mitch is professor of psychology at the State University of New York. He's author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the new book Pot Politics. We have links to the books at normalaudiostash.com. Mitch, it's great to have you back on the show today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on the podcast.
Wonderful to speak with you again this week, as always, Mitch. I know you're getting started there with the beginning of classes there at the State University of New York. And today, Mitch, I'd like to discuss something that came up in a Toronto Sun editorial by a reporter there. That reporter decided he was going to smoke some of, quote-unquote, today's marijuana after not having smoked pot in many years, and he said he found it different than the marijuana of yesteryear. We're talking about the 70s now. First, we've seen studies regarding cannabis potency that go kind of both ways. Some show that certain strains of cannabis have higher THC levels, but on average, pot hasn't increased in THC too much over the years. So on average, Mitch, do you think folks are getting more potent marijuana out there, do you think?
It looks like the average is up, but it's nowhere near the increase that the media would often suggest. So I've seen stories saying, oh, marijuana today is 100 times more potent, 10 times more potent, 8 times more potent. In fact, if you look at the averages, it's probably 3 times more potent. And people say, well, even that sounds really alarming. But in fact, when you start checking out our laboratory data, we notice that folks who smoke stronger cannabis tend to take smaller hits, they tend to hold it less long, and they tend to basically report that they're getting the same subjective experience or a comparable one. As John Morgan has said time and again, this idea that, marijuana is new and potent and crazy goes back to the probably 1970s, where people were suddenly jumping up and down saying the pot was so much stronger. But there's a wonderful lab out of University of Mississippi that examines the average THC content in cannabis and has basically shown we're in that 2 to 4% range for many decades, and now currently maybe we're up in that 6% range on average. It doesn't mean some wild, you know, extreme strains aren't available, and in fact, for medical users, particularly in the Netherlands, if it's not 14% THC, it can't be approved for pharmaceutical use. I want to emphasize, though, that that's actually a good thing. The less you actually have to smoke in order to get the desired effects, the less exposure you have to tars and nastiness and other potential problems. And so, in fact, stronger pot may, in effect, be better pot. Now, when we're talking about one person's impression about a memory from 30 years ago and intoxication experience today, obviously we run into a number of potential problems. I don't want to diss anybody's memory, but let's just say that how things were 30 years ago is subject to our own construction of our own narratives.
And how would someone experience higher potency THC? I mean, how much more potent would it need to be before an average consumer notices that there is more THC in the marijuana?
Oddly enough, we don't actually have the laboratory data. Tons and tons of folks have said, oh, this pot I have is really strong and it must be 14% THC, but there's nowhere to send it to find out. There's nowhere to do that in the U.S. and get a feel for what's going on with it. The range of THC in the cannabis that's available from NIDA is usually 0% THC, 2%, 4%, and if you're really lucky, you might be able to get your hands on the 8%. Obviously, there isn't a big variation, but people do report some differences. But it's interesting, too, because you see in the topography of the smoking, in the way they take the hits, how long they hold them, and all those kinds of things, experienced users change that accordingly. Now, if you're, say, not as young as you used to be, your lean body mass and the amount of actual physical body you have that's going to have that THC distributed has changed. Your sensitivity to drugs has changed over the years. Also, if you haven't had a drug for 30 years and you used to smoke it all the time, what a surprise, your tolerance is markedly lower. So, of course, your first time back, you might think, wow, this is markedly stronger than it used to be. But, in fact, anybody who takes a month off today notices that their tolerance drops pretty dramatically and discovers that that can sort of decrease their cannabis costs.
And let me ask this. Do people of different ages experience the high of marijuana differently, say, between a 21-year-old smoking and a 50-year-old?
It's again, an effort on my part to not sound ageist. But when you're younger, you tend to be more energetic, more resistant to a whole lot of things that might alter consciousness in general. And, you know, you're less prone to fatigue, less prone to all kinds of things. So, of course, the impact of a comparable dose is going to be smaller on somebody who's younger, whose body mass is primarily muscle, and who's really an experienced user and a recent experienced user compared to somebody who's older, not a frequent user any longer, and in a sense, not the same body mass or the same level of energy and verve, if you will.
And I was also struck with what wasn't said in this particular editorial. The author claims the pot is so much more potent and different than he remembers in the 70s, but at the same time, he didn't claim it was at all addictive, that, you know, he didn't want to just go out and get some more good cannabis. We already know that only 1 out of 10 regular cannabis consumers exhibit any signs of dependence.
That's an interesting point, because I feel like we think that higher concentration means must lead to worse problems, and that's just not the case. In fact, when you look at a more familiar drug, alcohol, you find that folks who drink beer are just as likely to become dependent as folks who drink whiskey, even though, yes, a shot of whiskey contains the same amount of alcohol as a whole 12-ounce beer, it's not that it makes that incremental a difference. I think people are concerned that, oh, this stronger pot is going to somehow hook people in and it's going to lead to more dependent symptoms markedly faster. In fact, if people are accustomed to using this stronger pot, they find they use markedly less. There's less exposure to potential problems for, you know, respiratory symptoms. And in the long run, no greater risk for dependence. Now, a couple years back, there was an article in JAMA, and Bruce Merkin and I wrote a letter trying to explain that some of the increases in dependence and abuse, and they lump those together in recent studies, have been attributed to, oh, it must be this new, stronger pot. In fact, one of the symptoms of abuse is problems with the law. And what a surprise, if you're using cannabis, you're at risk for problems with the law. And we noticed that the increased rates in this abuse and dependence group happened to be among folks who were non-white, folks who were Latino or of African or Caribbean descent. Surely the pharmacology of cannabis is not such that suddenly these people would be more sensitive to higher concentrations, but white people wouldn't. I think a better explanation is, guess who's getting arrested? And we've, you know, you've covered that on the show a couple of times now. And what a surprise, now we've got this illusion of worse dependence and abuse, when really one of the symptoms of abuse is getting arrested a lot, and that's in fact not in the control of the users right now, and something we all want to work to change.
And also, Mitch, I know there must be some commonalities to the feeling of cannabis high, but depending on the strain in the individual consumer's body, there are also some marked differences in the high as well. So, Mitch, what are some of those commonalities of the experiences? What are some of the differences? And does that perhaps affect how some people view this issue of modern cannabis today?
I talk about this extensively in a chapter in my book, Mind-Altering Drugs. And the bottom line is, we now have strains that we never had in the 1970s. And it's unclear exactly what proportion of what cannabinoids is creating these different effects, but they're drastically different. If you pick up, you know, one of Ed Rosenthal's books on buds and see all the reviews and all the different effects, clearly this is a species with so much variation, and then we are a species with so much variation that our responses are dramatically different. Generally, what do you see? In folks who are experienced users, you get the euphoria, and then either a mild stimulation or a mild sedation, and it's very strain dependent. So the idea that one person who smoked one strain 30 years ago could get a markedly different strain today that has effects that he or she didn't anticipate is very compelling. So, in fact, you could smoke one strain one day and another strain the following week and discover the one seems markedly stronger than the other, even if their THC content is the same, because of the proportion of the other cannabinoids and other things that may be contributing to the subjective effects.
Also, Mitch, are there any substances that elicit such an individualized reaction in the consumer?
In fact, alcohol does have a lot of variation. Chris Martin at University of Pittsburgh and I have shown some studies that there's a subset of folks who find alcohol mildly stimulating, others who find it completely sedating. And so, of course, this is a good predictor of who's going to develop troubles with alcohol. Some of the stimulant drugs, despite, you know, their name of being stimulant, the general increase in arousal and the decrease in arousal is very different for different people. A number of folks experience the opiates as very aversive. It's curious to find people who, you know, take OxyContin, which we would think of as this horribly addictive drug, and they basically say it makes me nauseated and I don't really like it at all, whereas other folks are ready to sell their houses in order to get more. So, obviously, our individual differences are, you know, a big contributor. Cannabis has a lot of variation, but in fact, other drugs seem to fit in this category as well.
And is there something else outside of the cannabis itself to this whole argument of then and now, Mitch? I mean, isn't this part of a generational thing, part of the psychology of human beings, for one generation to say to the next, it was so much different in my day?
What's funny is, I mean, there are citations in Plato basically having Socrates tell the young kids things were different in my day. We've been doing this for literally generations after generations. So the funny thing is let's take something that's a little more innocuous, a movie. You can imagine a movie that a whole set of 20-year-olds and a whole set of 60-year-olds would have a completely different response to, even though it's the exact same movie. You know, the idea that there are age-related differences in the impact of any stimulus is what developmental psychology is all about. So for one of us to say, hey, I smoked this cannabis and it's too strong now, never mind, an end to the legalization movement, is just preposterous. The idea that any one person is going to say, here, my response should be the determinant of what the entire country should do, is just inane. And if we're willing to say, hey, there are literally hundreds of thousands of people who use this regularly without any negative consequences, perhaps I could not be one of them, but let me give them the right to do as they wish.
And Mitch, again, you're starting up teaching again at State University of New York there. You're well known for your books and involvement with marijuana reform. Do you have college students who tell you about their first marijuana experiences? And if so, you know, what have you heard from these young adults?
I've literally had the full range. One of my colleagues, who shall remain nameless, who was on the faculty, has used cannabis two times and threw up both times.
Really?
I said, hey, this is obviously not the substance for you. He is a fan of alcohol, so, you know, he's got what he wants. I've had students come to me and say, I got so painfully self-conscious and self-aware that I just couldn't handle it at all. It's not my thing. And I say, go in peace. You know, obviously, this isn't for everybody. I've had other folks say, wow, it was okay. It's all right, you know. And other folks who say, wow, something about this really resonated for me. And, in fact, I'm a little apprehensive about that, so I decided not to use any more. And I say, go, good for you, too. And then I've got plenty of folks who are, you know, really very responsible, you know, once a week kind of users who have wonderful grades, very active in the community here, and seem to do particularly well under a whole lot of circumstances. It's a shame that they might be risking their financial aid or all kinds of other things because of the current legal structure.
Well, Mitch, another great conversation as always. I really appreciate you taking time to speak with us again this week and speaking with us every week here on the Audio Stash for our Cannabis Science segment.
I always have a great time, Chris. Thank you.
Thank you again, Mitch. Dr. Mitch Earlywine is professor of psychology at the State University of New York. He's author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the new book Pot Politics. We have links to the books at normalaudiostash.com. You can also check out a new column Mitch has each month in High Times magazine. He joins us every Wednesday here on the Audio Stash for our Cannabis Science segment. Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.